In a few nights, we will be sitting down to the Passover Seder. And if you had to ask people what is the most memorable moment, I think it would probably be that moment in which usually the youngest person in the house goes over to the door and opens the door for Elijah the prophet. According to our tradition, Elijah is going to walk in one year and announce the coming of the Messiah and the promise of redemption. Why Elijah? Well, Elijah is supposed to come back to announce the coming of the Messiah because Elijah didn't die. In the Bible, in the book of Kings, we are told that miraculously, Elijah, in a chariot and a whirlwind, is carried up to heaven in what is, after all, a very impressive scene. And we here on earth await the return of Elijah from heaven to let us know that the time of redemption is at hand. It really wasn't until last week, when I was thinking about Passover for this year, though, that a question occurred to me about opening the door for Elijah that actually I had never thought about before. Which is, here is a prophet of God who gets carried up mystically in a chariot to heaven. And by the way, that event serves as the catalyst for a whole school of Jewish mysticism called Merkava mysticism, the mysticism of the chariot, in which the visions of Ezekiel and the carrying up of Elijah combine. Here is somebody of clear and powerful connection to God. He's coming to earth to announce redemption for all of humanity. But if you don't open the door, he can't get inside. I thought, you know, it's a very strange thing. I just had this picture of Elijah waiting outside while the family is busy and going back to heaven and saying, you know, God, I was ready to bring redemption. Nobody opened the door. And if you think that this is a trivial or irrelevant question, I remind you that Elijah is also evoked at the end of Yom Kippur, at a bris, at Havdalah, and none of those times do we open the door. At a Brit Milah, we have a Kisei Eliyahu, a chair for Elijah, but nobody says open the door so Elijah can sit in the chair. By the way, just as an aside, you know why we have Elijah come to a Brit. There are two explanations. One is that Elijah got upset that the Jews were violating the covenant, so he has to be there every single time we enact the Brit, the covenant. But the other explanation is that, after all, any Jewish child could be born the Messiah. So Elijah has to be there at the ready, because we don't put enough pressure on our children. We actually, at the moment of birth, have to say, could be the Messiah here. So, why is it that we have to do this, and what is it that we expect that Elijah's really going to usher in? I mean, when Elijah comes in one year, to our surprise, and says, okay, redemption is at hand, what's that going to be about anyway? And maybe if we understand redemption, we can understand why we open the door. The first concept of redemption, the most common, is that it will be somehow supernatural. The whole order of the world will be overturned. Nothing will be the same as it was the day before redemption. The lion will lay down with the lamb is the eschatological image that people use. Eschatology is the study of the end of time, what will happen when everything is over. And that idea of the lion laying down with the lamb, well, you know Woody Allen's line. He says, the lion will lay down with the lamb, but one of them won't get much sleep. But that idea of the lion laying down with the lamb, even though It seems at first blush, at first glance, to be clearly a supernatural image, an overturning of the order of nature, is actually not always interpreted that way. The Rambam, Maimonides in the Middle Ages, said the lion laying down with the lamb means big nations, which are compared to lions, and small nations, compared to lambs, will get along in peace. And that, in fact, the Messianic Age won't be an age of supernatural overturning of the order of nature, but rather, it will be the promise inherent in the order of nature being fulfilled. It is possible for people to be peaceful. That promise will be fulfilled. It is conceivable that nations will make policy by morality and not only by self-interest, and that promise will be fulfilled. All those ideas about what it is to realize ultimate human potential will be fulfilled in the Messianic Age. And therefore, according to Maimonides, the ultimate image with which he closes his great code of law, the Mishneh Torah, the ultimate image of perfection in Messianic times is that the knowledge of the Lord will fill the earth as the waters fill the sea. An image taken from the prophet Isaiah. But then there is another and complementary image. And this is the one that I want to elaborate on because I think it gives us an insight into why it is that we open the door for Elijah. In order to do this, however, we have to remember that despite the fact that the Exodus takes place in the book of Exodus, there is a book that precedes Exodus, and that's the book of Genesis. And after all, as any good writer, playwright, poet will tell you, you always have to go back to the beginning of the story if you want to understand the premise on which the second part of the story is based. So since the end of the story is messianism and messianic redemption, let's go back to Genesis for a minute and see what most of the book is about. God creates a family, Adam and Eve. They sin. Then God gives them children, Cain and Abel. They sin. Right? One of them kills the other. Then various problems, Tower of Babel, Flood of Noah, actually first Flood of Noah, then Tower of Babel. And God says, all right, this is what I'm going to do. God doesn't say this, but we can, little sermonic license here. God says, okay, it's clear to me that to create a whole world and expect them to behave well is just beyond human capacity. So I'm going to make one family, one representative family. And they're going to behave nicely. And everybody will learn by watching that family what it is that people are supposed to be like. So he chooses Abraham and Sarah. Now I'm going to give you a very quick précis for those of you who don't remember your Genesis very well. And if you don't, Torah classes are Thursday morning at 8:15. I'm going to give you a quick précis of what happens in the book of Genesis. First of all, Abraham twice passes his wife off as his sister. Second, since he seems unable to have a child with Sarah, he has a child with his handmaiden Hagar. The child is named Ishmael. Hagar and Sarah have a falling out, not much of a surprise. Ishmael gets kicked out of the house, gets brought back to the house, will later get kicked out again. Finally, Abraham and Sarah have a child, his name is Isaac. Isaac grows up in the house until Abraham takes him out to the mountain to slaughter him as a sacrifice. Not so far a happy family. God rescues Isaac. Isaac grows up. He marries Rebekah. They have two children. The two children are Jacob and Esau. Jacob steals his brother's birthright by fooling his old blind father Isaac with the connivance of his mother Rebekah. Esau says, when dad dies, I'm going to kill you. Jacob runs away. There he runs away. He marries the wrong woman because he really wanted to marry her sister, right? He ends up, he marries Leah, but he really wanted to marry Rachel. He waits for a while, marries Rachel too. Rachel and Leah, this will astonish you, develop a rivalry between them, right? I'm not making this up. I mean, this is all, you know. They develop a rivalry between them. Rachel gives birth to a child named Joseph. She dies, by the way, giving birth to her second child. Jacob finally reconciles with Esau, more or less. They seem to reconcile. Then Jacob brings up his children. Among them, of course, his beloved son Joseph, whom the other brothers plan to kill. But because this is the Bible and God has chosen a family to be nice, instead they just sell him into slavery rather than killing him. And they don't see him for years and years and years, and they go back to the father holding his bloody, many-colored coat and say, by the way, Joseph is dead. Jacob does or doesn't believe them. It's not entirely clear. The Bible says that he believes them, but there are hints that maybe he's not sure. And many, many years later, he's reconciled with Joseph and says a blessing on all the children, in the course of which he has not so nice things to say about Shimon and Levi, but I left their massacre out of this. And the book of Genesis comes to a sweet close. So what's the point here? The point is that families are difficult things. They're tough. Families are, as I have many, many times said, God's attempt to teach you how to live with people that you wouldn't choose as your friends if they weren't part of your family. Right? But they are. So you don't have a choice. And that's why we have holidays. Right? As the comedian Kathy Landman once said, holidays are your chance to renew resentments afresh. Right? That's what they're here for. You forgot how much cousin so-and-so annoys you. Come Pesach, you can remember. Pesach is, after all, a holiday of memory. Now, everyone knows that this is true. We all realize how difficult families are. In fact, one of the great realizations as we grow is that when we're children, we think families are preset units. When we are adults and we choose someone to marry, we realize that families are a product of choice. When you grow up, your family is a given. You think it was there forever. When you marry, you realize it's something you create. But whether you're on the creating side or on the founding side, it's tough. It's hard to live in proximity with other people, with other needs. And therefore, as always happens, family occasions and holidays and all the things that bring families together are filled with not just excitement, but also difficulty and strife and worry. Now let's go back to the Seder. Passover is the quintessential family holiday. In fact, when you ask people what their favorite holiday is, if they name Passover, it's always because the family gets together on Passover. That's what the Seder is. It's supposed to be a grand gathering, not just of people who you bring in, but also of your family. And what is it? What is it to experience messianic times? This morning's Haftarah is from the book of Malachi. It is no mistake that we read it right before Passover. Because the last sentences of that Haftarah, the prophet Malachi says, here comes the great day of judgment of God. In other words, the messianic times. And what is it that Malachi says will happen on messianic times? V'yeshiv lev avot al banim v'lev banim al avotam. I will turn the hearts of parents to children and children to parents. In other words, if You can make the family work. It is a foretaste of messianic times. And I think you opened the door to Elijah, not because he needs to get in, but because we need to show him that we did it. That we took all these people with disparate interests and so on and so forth, including the immortal uncle who says, "You carved the turkey," for those of you who remember that movie, and show him that we created a certain amount of harmony in our home. That we turned our hearts to one another. That we managed to make it through another year and live together despite the difficulties and the challenges which are real and exist in every family. My friend and colleague Joseph Telushkin has said to me many times that his mother used to tell him, "The only happy families I know are families I don't know very well." But once you actually know a family, you see the stresses and the strains and the difficulties and the trials and the problems, and they exist everywhere. And the way you know they exist everywhere is every single time I've quoted Rabbi Telushkin, everybody smiles and nods their head. So that's what it's about. That's why we opened the door. That's what we have to show, is that we took the most difficult assignment, which is not to overturn the order of nature, but to live harmoniously within the order of nature, with parents and children and brothers and sisters and grandparents and grandchildren and aunts and uncles and cousins and all the constituent parts that make up that problematic unit, the family, which, to paraphrase Churchill on democracy, is the worst form of human organization except for all the others. V'yashid lev avot al banim, v'lev banim al avotam. On Passover, as during the year, what is it that we are searching for? To turn the hearts of husbands and wives, parents and children, grandparents and grandchildren, cousins, aunts, uncles, everyone, in-laws to one another. And to show that in fact the vision of the prophet is utopian, but not impossible, and that we can live on this Pesach in a family, not perfectly, but understanding each other, tolerating each other, and loving each other. Shabbat Shalom.